I got to see Neil Gaiman over the weekend.
It's true. How'd that go?
Dude, it was pretty flippin' sweet.
I'm sure.
I'd never been to a, like, writer's, you know, a reading where writers read mm-hmm. parts of their stories or whatever. But it was phenomenal. It was just him by himself.
Big turnout?
Huge. It was like 2,000 people probably. Wow. Like 1,600, 1,800. But he comes out, and it's kind of funny. He has question cards. And he's like, a lot of people ask me why I don't... And we used to do a Q&A where you pass the microphone around. And he says, and it's all very lovely, and everybody's got very nice questions that I, you know, sometimes I have to think about. And he says, and everybody's just... There's all this love in the room, and finally the microphone comes to this guy, and he's like, I've never actually read anything you've written, but some of the stuff you're talking about has given me some ideas, and I'd like to talk to you about some of these ideas. He goes, and then all of a sudden, this room full of love turns to this entire just driving hate for that one guy.
Person, right.
He's like, so we're going to stop that. He says, I had everybody write their questions. I chose a few, so he went through questions, and, you know, read the question, answered them.
Right. Yeah, sometimes it's not best to do everything impromptu and just allow things to flow naturally.
But, you know, then he'd read short stories out of a couple of his books. You know, some of his short stories and stuff. Which was really neat because he was doing the voices. So you heard what was in his head when he was writing the story and stuff. So he was doing one out of the new Norse mythology. So it was a story of Thor and Loki and a giant. And he was doing, like, Thor's voice and Loki's voice.
Cool, man.
And, you know, it was very, very neat. It was a lot of fun. It was badass. And probably one of the coolest things, I don't know how familiar you are with Terry Pratchett.
A little bit.
Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman were really good friends, and they wrote Good Omens together. And so Terry Pratchett recently, within the last year or so, passed away. He died of cancer. And Neil was saying that one of the things that he didn't write any of the screenplay parts for American Gods, and he hasn't done any of the screenplay parts for some other stuff, and he hasn't done another Doctor Who. There's a lot of stuff he hasn't done in the last, like, year. He says because one of the last things Terry Pratchett asked him was that he would write the entire screenplay for Good Omens, which is coming out on BBC through Amazon Prime.
Okay.
So he wrote the whole thing. And then he said, the thing is, whenever you write a screenplay for a TV show, certain scenes get cut for one reason or another. So he read two cut scenes. So you'll be the only people that ever hear this. You know, that ever really see these scenes. Mm-hmm. And then he read the cut scenes. So that was really neat.
Man,
you know,
yeah.
Super cool. Favorite writer. Some of my favorite books ever, so...
Was there a signing part, too? Or?
No, he actually explained, one of his questions is, like, why aren't you doing signings? He says, well, there's 2,000 of you. So he says, if we started when I'm done, then by like 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd be in quite a bit of pain, and there'd still be about 1,400 left of you, and by 5 or 6 in the morning, you know, everybody would be mad, and I would be basically dead, and he says, it just doesn't work. So he had actually, Bedrock City was there. Before the event, he had signed like 500 pieces that they were selling.
Okay.
So you could buy something signed. But I didn't bring anything, but people were carrying books.
Just in case.
And I was like, damn, dude, how much would that suck if, like, you know, I've got all the first edition hardcovers at home, and I'd have to buy something to get signed just to meet him. But he didn't do it. Okay. So. Which is fine.
Yeah.
You know.
Pretty great experience anyway, though.
Yeah. So one of these days, I'll catch him at a signing. You know, I've got several things signed by him, but I've never had anything signed in person.
Right.
I bought some stuff that was sent, you know, I ordered Ocean at the End of the Lane from a bookshop that he had, you know, they were selling signed copies. Okay. And I bought a couple of things that already had signatures on it.
Okay.
So, one of these days.
Very cool.
Good stuff. Well, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Dude, you know which one this is?
I think we're getting back into cryptids.
This is episode 40, bro.
We're almost over the hill. We have reached the summit.
We're episode 40.
We have reached the summit of the hill.
This is episode 40 of Scary Dad Podcast.
Episode 40, and we still got plenty of stuff to talk about, which is pretty
impressive. We got stuff stacking up. this will be, it'll be about half of a cryptid and then half of, you know, folklore, basically. But this is our cryptids part two, and this will be vampires.
Yes, bloodsuckers.
Blood-sucking
creatures.
Not ex-wives, not ex-girlfriends. Cryptids, guys. Cryptids. This is landing on July 17th, 2017. So, kick back. This is probably going to be a long one.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a lot to talk about. Cryptids are always fun, though.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Well, we've got quite the history segment tonight. So, you ready to talk about some old business?
Let's get into it.
And actually, you know, some of it's scary, some of it's just interesting. This date, July 17th, 1867, Harvard School of Dental Medicine opens. It's the first university-affiliated dental school. So if you're scared of going to dentist, imagine how scared it was, how scared you would have been prior to them having like a college level course in dentistry.
Actual, you know, training.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason, you know, we talked about it like in the last episode when we were talking about the Civil War stuff. There's a reason doctors have the nickname Sawbones. Now, I don't know if they called dentists yankers or whatever before, but I'm pretty sure that's pretty much all they did was just yank them out.
Yeah. Yeah, to keep it simple.
Yeah.
God, about my idea of a dentist when I was young, this was just gruesome. It was taking me to my grandmother's house, and I fell for it every time when I was a kid. But she would ask me to show her the tooth that was hurting. I would do it every time, and then she would reach in with two fingers and grab whatever tooth it was and pull it out by her fingers.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. That was the dentist for me until I was around 17 years old.
Are you missing teeth now?
No. It was only baby teeth that she had to pull, so. But yeah, that was, and I fell for it every time. I'm not going to pull it, I just want to see it.
Right. This date in 1902, Willis Carrier invents the first air conditioner.
Praise him.
Dude, for real.
It's been hot.
Uh-huh.
It's been miserable hot.
It's been 100 degrees. And it keeps on doing that piss rain where it's only, it just turns into a steam bath.
Yeah.
Man, oh man. This date in 1955, Disneyland was dedicated and opened in Anaheim, California.
A big part of our...
big time.
Culture.
This one's scary and kind of sucks. And the date's apropos. 1984. The national drinking age changed from 18 to 21.
Except for Louisiana.
Big brother getting into your business. Okay. You grew up in Louisiana.
Yes.
I didn't. So shortly after we turned 18, my buddy Chris from Dudes and Beer said, hey, let's go visit my grandmother. I've probably told this story before.
Yeah, he used to have lots of Texas friends come over to Louisiana.
Man, we crossed that border. Not only do they sell, like, handles of whiskey in the convenience store. You know, I mean, like, they sold it to 18-year-old kids, but you didn't even have to go to the liquor store to buy it.
Right.
You could just go down the street, and you're buying your Ho-Hos and your Diet Coke and a handle of SoCo.
Yeah, the drugstore. They used to have alcohol everywhere, man. You couldn't get away from it. Drive through daiquiri places when I was growing up.
Now, to be fair, y'all had your own natural speed bumps.
Yeah. Yeah, our federal highway fund was shit because of the fact that we allowed 18-year-olds to drink, but... And that's the only reason that it changed, because the roads
finally
going,
fell apart.
Yeah, it started going so bad, we had to get some kind of funding.
Alrighty. Notable births. 1935. Donald Sutherland.
I was watching Animal House a couple days ago.
Scary, scary dude. 1949, Geezer Butler of Black Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
1952, David Hasselhoff.
Look at that. Knight Rider himself.
Happy birthday, Dave. 1965, Alex Winter. He was Bill and Bill and Ted.
Okay.
He was also the one vampire in Lost Boys.
Yeah.
Notable deaths this date in 1918, the entire Romanov family. But bye bye, Czar. Hello, comrade. 1959, soul singer Billie Holiday. 1961, Ty Cobb. Apparently a big asshole, not misbehaving very much.
Yes, yes, I have heard that.
1967, John Coltrane. Jazz.
Yep. Yeah, I got some of his 78s over here, as a matter of fact.
So that's old business.
Okay.
What you got in new business?
I got a few movies to discuss tonight. One of my favorite series, Puppet Master. They've released a nice little trailer and gave a little nice little synopsis of what the movie's going to be about that they're coming out with. The trailer is probably the bloodiest Puppet Master trailer I've ever seen in my life. So as I'd imagine already, just with current CGI and stuff, the special effects are going to be pretty badass. These puppets are going to be killer, as they say. They've come out with a really, really awesome poster, too, just giving you a hint of some of the new puppets that are going to be coming out, including one werewolf Nazi puppet, which looks pretty badass. Synopsis on this they consider it the final chapter of the Axis saga. Began with Axis of Evil and continued with Axis Rising. Everyone's favorite pint-sized puppet anti-heroes, Blade, Pinhead, Tunneler, Jester, Six-Shooter, and Leech Woman, who is always disgusting, join forces with a secret team of psychics working as allied operatives. And they'll be teaming up with Toulon's marionettes and these unlikely allies to face off against a new pack of evil Nazis. So they're going back to the old theme of the Nazis trying to get a hold of Toulon's secrets. And the Nazis actually get a hold of some. They design their own puppets to fight against the heroes of the movie. They'll have a showdown that will decide the future of the free world. But it looks interesting. It's going to hold true to the Puppet Master ideals.
I need to go back and rewatch the old Puppet Masters.
You know how many Puppet Masters they have?
A lot.
I got them all over here.
Isn't there like eight of them?
Eight, yes. There are eight of them. I have every single one of them over here, as a matter of fact. But you see the poster really references all the Nazi stuff going on with it. It looks like it's going to be an interesting one for sure.
Sweet.
All right. Carolyn Cronenberg, whose husband, that I'm sure you're familiar with, David Cronenberg. She passed away recently at the age of 66. Now, Carolyn also worked in the business as editor on Fast Company and The Brood, and also directed Acts of Violence in 2006. And that was a behind-the-scenes documentary about her husband, David. That documentary was called A History of Violence. So she has passed away at 66. Our condolences to the Cronenberg family. Of course, David has definitely been a staple in the horror genre for sure. Texas Chainsaw, the prequel Leatherface, has set a release date, which it has been talked about for a while now, but it will be released August 25th, 2017 in London at the Frightfest Con out that way. Then it will be exclusively on DirecTV September 21st, 2017, and will eventually be a full video on demand through all channels, I guess you could say, October 20th, 2017. So it's going to be a prequel about Leatherface, him coming up, how he was as a youth, kind of the one Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake where they kind of went into a little bit of when Leatherface was born, so on and so forth. There's going to be an expansion of that, so... the other one I was going to mention, if you guys get a chance, check out our Facebook page or our Twitter feed. There was a theme song originally made for Child's Play that I stumbled upon today. And with the Cult of Chucky about to come out, I figured it'd be something cool to go ahead and post. Back in 1988, singer Simon Stokes wrote and performed the Chucky song, which was supposed to be the official theme song for Child's Play. And it was supposed to play over the closing credits. It was so gloriously terrible that they decided to cut it from that and switch it to one of Stokes' instrumentals to play over the credits. But the Chucky rap is out there and available for listening on YouTube. If you get a chance, check it out. Like I said, it's on our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. It is a long song. It is almost 5 minutes long, believe it or not. So yeah, it's a little bit to bear, but if you can bear with it for a little while, you'll definitely get a laugh.
It's not one of those things that gets better.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to. Like I said, my kids were in the room, and my daughter's just obsessed with anything that's got blood on it or looks a little bit scary. My older daughter's like, "What is that?" My younger daughter's like, "What is that too?" But she like looks through her fingers. And then both of them bug me after it's bedtime. I'm scared.
So. So that's it for news today.
All right, all right, all right. So let's talk about blood-sucking creatures.
Let's do that.
There's enough of them with the soupy-ass weather that we're having.
Oh, yeah.
Thank the Lord.
These mosquitoes are terrible this year.
Thank the Lord for Mr. Carrier for inventing that first air conditioner on July 17th, 1902. Jeez.
But, you know, I would love to find an EMP-type device for mosquitoes that you just press a button and all mosquitoes within 1,000 yards would just fall from the sky and die.
Oh, yeah.
Because they are terrible, right? And they're aggressive. They don't stop coming after you, man.
You know what? It's even worse, and you're probably... I've probably mentioned this on the show before too, but like I never used to be affected by mosquitoes ever. Like even when they bit me, it didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple years ago, I got bit by or got stung by a wasp, and it was like a real like direct hit. Like he got me good, and it like the only thing I can figure out completely changed my physiology.
So really?
now when a mosquito bites me, man, that shit whelps up. It itches. It lasts for like days and days days. It's like. So I'm just like pure miserable right now.
Jesus.
Sucks.
Okay.
So let's talk about the cryptid zoo.
Yes, our cryptid topic for tonight are going to be bloodsuckers. Vampire-like cryptids. Not everybody believes in vampires, but, you know, a lot of things have happened over history where people tried to explain what was causing them. And just vampire-type creatures were always the fall to go to.
Now let's go ahead and kind of set the stage here. So anybody that we'll get into the human type, you know, sanguine type guy, mm-hmm. right? At this point, we're talking about critters,
right?
And then moving up into myths and legends and how these critters kind of that do exist. There's no question that things like vampire bats have.
Right.
Absolutely. Mosquitoes, absolutely. Ticks, absolutely. They exist. So there are things that most certainly live off the blood of other creatures.
Right, leeches.
Right. So this isn't one of those things where we can say, well, it's half busted or whatever, you know. But there are some out there that are legendary, perhaps, that aren't necessarily proven.
Yeah.
And where we have to circle our the word yet, because who knows?
Right.
So where to begin, Scotty?
Okay, well, we could talk, let's just be free on where the idea of these creatures would have come from, and of course that's from vampires. Most of us know what we know about vampires from movies, from books, from comic books, from, you know, different things like that. Vampires found in fiction look mostly human, but they are beings who need blood. For real, humans are to survive, and they often shapeshift into different creatures and everything. Whether it be bats, wolves, whatever the particular legend that you're looking into is calling for. Vampires and folklore are similar in some respects, yet very different in most ways. They're a type of quasi-physical blood-sucking ghost. They seldom shapeshift, and if they do, bats are one of the least common animals for them to turn into. Folklore vampires were humans at one time, but they died. After death, they rise from their graves in some manner and feed on the living. Each morning, they must return to their graves. And then, we have the cryptozoology take on everything. Cryptozoologists have practically no interest in vampires, because vampires are humans and, you know, they go with the old mythos.
There's something along the lines of there's a spiritual aspect to it.
Yeah. Cryptozoology is about looking for new types of animal. Not only is a vampire just a modified human rather than a separate species, it is also rather supernatural, which is a further disqualification. The usual type of folklore vampire receives almost no attention in cryptozoology. However, there is another category of beings that you could call vampires, and these beings do receive a great deal of attention from cryptozoologists. These are the vampire animals and plants, creatures like the chupacabra and the giant vampire bat. There are countless animals and plants, including known species as well as cryptids, that have been attributed with the ability to feed on blood. Leeches, mosquitoes, vampire bats are all examples of creatures accepted by mainstream science that drink blood. There are also many real animals that have been falsely attributed with blood-sucking habits by folklore, most notably the house cat. And that's one of the, in folklore, you know, house cats have been blamed for all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be drinking blood, causing asthma, stealing one's breath, all kinds of things. Monsters that are attributed with vampire-like habits are numerous. Most of these animals are so bizarre and obviously supernatural that they either don't get much attention from cryptozoology community, or if they do, the blood-sucking aspects of these reports are thrown out as obviously mythical. But there are plenty of slightly more normal blood-sucking cryptids left over for cryptozoologists to study. One vampire animal is the death bird of Ethiopia. Are you familiar with that one?
I've heard of it, but
Actually described as bats by those who report them, these creatures are much larger than the three known species of vampire bat, which all reside in North and South America. There are not supposed to be any vampire bats in Africa, Asia, or Europe. Thus, if this animal were confirmed, it would be a new species. Ethiopian death birds are described as having wingspans of about a foot, twice as big as a common vampire bat. I mean, you've seen vampire bats in the zoo. They're small. It has been suggested that their blood-drinking habits are folklore and that the bats are actually contaminating the water supply with their excrement, spreading an infection called whale's disease. This illness causes hemorrhages to break out in the skin, which look like bites. And that is why they are sometimes attributed with being a vampire bird. Another reputed vampire creature is the Mambu Muto, which we're going to get into in a little bit. Kind of blood-sucking, brain-eating mermaid from Lake Tanganyika in Africa. Cryptozoologists think these reports could represent freshwater manatees or even some kind of otter-based animal. And, of course, there are several blood-drinking trees that are reported around the world, different plants. It's wide and varied, the number of animals that we look at as cryptids. And we can go ahead and get into specific ones. I'm not sure if there's some you wanted to discuss in general.
Well, I was looking kind of more at the idea of the vampires themselves. And okay. Kind of, you know, kind of one of those things of, again, looking logically, you can classify just about all kinds of spiders as a vampire. Because the way spiders feed is they inject their venom, it melts the critter from the inside, and then they suck the juice from the inside.
They get the nutrients from
it's
that.
Not, you know, well, you won't necessarily call it blood per se, but the blood's in there.
Right.
You know, whatever, you know, liquid parts of the body are ingested.
Right.
And there's quite a few animals that do that. I mean, even certain snakes, their venom, I mean, that's what it does, is it causes necrosis. It causes the flesh to dissolve so that they can crush it down and eat it easier. So there's a lot of biological vampirism, per se. It's not necessarily... The creature is not necessarily drawn by blood itself. There is not a drive to drink, you know, the red stuff. But, you know, if you've ever watched a dog... They'll lick up blood. They'll sit there and they'll lick it right up. People drink blood. We don't. I mean, it's used in recipes.
Recipes, right?
You know, I remember a long time ago watching that one guy Zimmer, who goes, and he was in Asia somewhere, and they were serving duck blood soup, and if you wanted duck blood soup, they had a little hot pad with a bowl. And if you ordered duck blood soup, they'd go over and they'd cut the head off of a duck and then drain the blood into the bowl and then garnish it with a little bit of spice and then hand you the bowl. It was just warmed up blood with some spice on it.
In Louisiana, there was actually, growing up, it's illegal now to actually sell through butcher shops or grocery stores, but there was something called blood boudin, which it was boudin where they would actually take the blood of the animal and mix it with the rice and everything else and then steam it from there. So the boudin actually had a red maroon color to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good. I remember eating it when I was a kid and everything, but that's another example of that.
So the to separate some of the folklore from some of the actual biological just feeding habits of certain creatures, kind of takes a little of the mystery out of it, but, you know, like the birds you're talking about, or, you know, the fact that they haven't necessarily witnessed the bird drinking the blood doesn't necessarily mean that the bird doesn't.
Right.
Or that that's all it eats, but maybe it's an opportunist.
Yeah, and it gets the chance to go.
You know, it's like, hey, there's some blood, I'll eat, you know, I'll chew on that.
Right.
Just like a dog would. So... The I guess the suspension of disbelief or the skepticism factor on this one is quite a bit lower on what could be an actual blood-sucking creature, because there's a lot of them that we don't even consider that that kind of are.
Yeah, we don't put it in that category.
Right.
Right.
So, on to the new one. On to the next one. What you got?
Okay. Well, one which this kind of falls from one of our most common bloodsuckers, which we talk about all the time, but mosquitoes. Mosquitoes are just vicious. And mm-hmm. They suck blood. Period. That's what they do. They suck blood until they blow up, I think, sometimes. You know, they just don't know when to stop. Well, there's a creature known as the Avarasboro gallinapper, which is an interesting name because, like I told you earlier, my ex-wife used to refer to the large, long-legged mosquitoes, sometimes called mosquito hawks, as a gallinapper. And a gallinapper is a giant mosquito, reportedly as large as a hawk. The sting it carries on its head could slice all the way through a man's arm. Bite from the gallinapper could mean death. The mosquito could drain all the blood from a man in a single gulp. And the gallinapper is reported by the lumbermen of North Carolina. So it's fairly close. It's a regional thing. Legend of the gallinapper originates around the now abandoned town of Avarasboro. However, many coastal towns in North Carolina have similar versions of the story. And this is just going back to big-ass mosquitoes.
So the legend originates in a town that no longer has people living in it.
Right. The gallinappers ate them all.
Somebody them. Made them leave anyway.
The earliest accounts of giant mosquito come from the local American Indian traditional mythology. Okay, so...
the mosquito's eating that kid.
Yeah, it's carrying away your kids, man. Yeah, so Indian tribes reported back as far back as 1715, reporting these giant mosquitoes that could carry people away. And it flew about with vast wings, making a loud noise with a long stinger. And on whomsoever it lighted, it sucked all the blood and killed them. Many warriors were destroyed in this way, and all attempts to subdue it were in vain. You got to wonder, could it have been, you know, at that time, just mosquitoes passing around diseases where they'd mm-hmm. get bitten by these large mosquitoes that, you know, they would kind of go overboard with the descriptions, but they'd end up passing away with some type of fever.
Yeah.
And it was attributed to the mosquito actually sucking all their blood. It's a nice artist rendition of a gallinapper right there.
See, that looks a little bit bigger than a, like, that's
yeah, that's, it's got hands. And has thumbs. It has opposable thumbs, which mosquitoes normally don't have those types of things.
We're just talking about Mrs. Cronenberg.
Wow. But yeah, so that's one of them.
That looks like a brundle fly right there.
Yeah, it sure does, man. It sure does. Got to look at the teeth on that thing. Yeah, so that's one. That's the gallinapper, which is just a giant mosquito, which... Mosquitoes are mosquitoes. I've seen different sized mosquitoes. You know, some of them are huge. I remember taking a picture of a mosquito that was the size of an entire penny, which is a big ass mosquito.
Well, I remember telling somebody,
yeah, so there we are with that North Carolina and staying in that area. We're going to talk about the vampire beast, aka the Beast of Bladenboro, which was a vampire-like monster that made several livestock and pet killings in Bladenboro, North Carolina, in December of 1954. It lasted for 10 days. Then in 2007, the beast returned, but in other regions such as Bolivar, Greensboro, and Lexington. This one I found rather interesting because when I was a youth, I remember I had an uncle of mine, something was killing his livestock. Couldn't figure out what it was. And he called Wildlife and Fisheries, came down, took paw prints, huge paw prints, and they were actually thinking it was a puma that had somehow escaped. There was an air base not far from where he lived, and they were thinking that possibly an airplane that was passing through it stopped to fuel up, and some big cat had got loose. Ended up being a timber wolf, which is not native to South mm-hmm. Louisiana, and when they killed it, it was a huge 200 plus pound timber wolf that was killing his livestock. Yeah, this is very similar to that, as far as is just some... apparently some kind of big cat was just killing people's livestock and pets for a few days, and then all of a sudden
stopped doing
disappeared,
it.
Disappeared, yeah. Killings first happened on December 29th, 1954, when a farmer reported a large cat-like beast had attacked one of his dogs and dragged it in an underbrush. More killings happened on New Year's Day, where two dogs were found dead, and all of the blood was drained out. So you got to realize, you know, when these cats attack, they normally attack at the jugular. They get you around the throat. You can imagine something's going to bleed out whenever mm-hmm. it's cut like that. Next day, two more dogs were attacked, and January 6, 1954, 21-year-old mother named Mrs. Kinlaw walked outside one morning at 7:30 and saw the beast stalking towards her. She screamed and ran inside the house. Her husband ran out with a shotgun and saw the beast left cat-like paw prints. Former reported the mystery killer killed three of his hogs, some of his cows, and one of his goats. Goat's head was fat and fritter. People also heard weird noises that sounded cat-like. Some sounded like a baby crying and a woman screaming. Locals reported seeing a creature that was part bear and part panther, which would be interesting to see. It was 3 to 4 foot long, 20 inches high, weighing 150 pounds, brownish and tabby with bushy fur. The beast also has runty-looking ears and a long tail with a cat-like face. These were the only descriptions of the vampire beast. They hunted for the creature, never found anything, and the killings eventually stopped. So then in 2007, the beast returned, bringing more surprises and fear with it. In Lexington, 60 goats were found with their blood drained and their heads crushed. 30 miles away in Greensboro, another farmer lost his goats in the same way. In Bolivia, a man named Bill Robinson lost his pit bull to the creature. He buried it, but the next day it was in the same location where it was killed. Something had dug it up and pulled it out. 4 days later, another resident found his pit bull dead. It was covered in blood and was missing a few body parts. There was a sign of a struggle, which is strange for a pit bull. Other places lost a total amount of 10 dogs in just 2 weeks. And then once again, it stopped again. And that was the Beast of Bladenboro.
So there's a couple of things that you can talk about for that. My parents lost a dog to a bobcat.
Mm-hmm.
They never saw the cat, but just the way that the dog was killed, and then they called out animal control, and they went back and they looked. My parents live, strangely enough, their house backs up, and it opens up to a green space, and from their backyard through their chain link fence, you can see the high school football field, and it's about 200 or 300 yards out. So there's this green space about 200 or 300 yards wide that is maintained by the city. But city doesn't maintain very good, so right. The grass gets pretty tall back there. So whenever the animal control came out, they found these twisted beds of tall grass. It's basically the way that bobcats burrow. You know, it's like the bed. So they're like, oh yeah, it was a bobcat. That's what it is. But the cat, obviously, he didn't eat the dog. Basically, he was coming for the dog's food. The dog put up a fight. The cat gutted him. You know, gave him basically three claws right up the belly,
mm-hmm.
and the dog bled out. And I guess the cat either took whatever food he wanted, but he didn't. He didn't like. He basically just took out the sentry, so to speak.
So he could eat.
So he could eat. But you know, if you think about the way, like you said, cats kill, especially if this was one that was sick or you know out of its element, if you know it'd gotten away from. A collector or a circus or just whatever, or you know there are large cats. I mean, we've got mountain lion, you know, not mountain lions. Well, technically,
yeah,
mountain lions living in Texas all over the place, you know.
And they roam.
And they roam and they stalk. But if you think about the way a cat kills, they kill something and then they pull it up into a tree.
Right.
And if it's you know, gravity's going to do its work. They pull it up, it'll bleed out while they're up in the tree, and then they move it somewhere else, and then you find it, you know, all the blood's gone.
Drained, right.
And blood doesn't take too long to go away. I mean, it dries up, it crystallizes, it turns to dust pretty, you know, it turns to fertilizer. So, if you're not looking, you're not going to find that blood 20, 30 feet away if, you know, he died over there and they moved him over here.
Right.
So, you know, that's not too hard to believe. And then especially if it was sick, if it was rabid, or, you know, it ran into something bigger than itself.
Right.
You know, maybe it come across a bear, and bear dispatched it. And
yeah, it's over. The killings are over with
now.
And staying on the topic of cats, now let's move over to India and look at the Pishacha, which is loosely translated to the flesh eaters. The Pishacha is described as having red swollen eyes, bulging veins, being active in late hours of night. They aren't exactly demons, which they've been classified as that by the locals in India. Since the ancient Vedas placed them lower than demons, describing them as far more malignant
as the vilest of male avian beings, often described as red swollen eyes on a tiger, just a large tiger. In India, there's a lot of tigers. I mean, I'm sure you've seen YouTube videos that they've had of, you know, tigers attacking people in India.
Mm-hmm.
They're said to have the power to assume different forms of will, and may also become invisible. They feed on human energies, possessing human beings, and adhering to thoughts, causing mental abnormalities. They're known for killing, draining the blood of their victims that they have killed, and consuming some of the flesh. Like I said, this very much sounds like just a tiger that is loose in a village killing people. And just attributing it, like we were just saying, the way cats kill, they can drain the blood from something just by, you know, just the kill shot that they use, wherever they cut or bite.
Well, my dad used to tell me this story, and, you know, he would never have any reason really to lie, but he would say that whenever he was either in college or just out of college, he and his buddy used to like to go hunting. They had this old guy that had a lease, and they'd go out and just, he and his buddy Dennis would go out and they'd camp and build a fire, you know, pitch their tents, and then, you know, sit around, drink beer and stuff, and then the next morning they'd go find their, you know, they'd go sit in their blinds and hunt for deer. Well, one night they were sitting at the fire, and one of the two of them glanced up and saw glowing red eyes looking back at them. Well, they had their guns with them, you know, their hunting rifles, you know, and my dad never had a pistol for as long as I knew. Like, he had several hunting rifles, and he had some 22s, but nothing, you know, nothing in a defense capacity sort of thing. But, you know, he had his bolt action 30-06, and, you know, Dennis had whatever he had. And anyway, he noticed the thing in the light. He just kind of, you know, he was behind Dennis, noticed the red eyes, thought, this can't be good. So he, without trying to move real fast, he slowly reached over and grabbed his gun and chambered a round, and was bringing the rifle up to look through the scope to see what it was, and it broke cover and started coming at him. So he shot it, and it went down. And as soon as he shot it, there's this big old loud bunch of howling, and one by one, these other creatures started breaking, you know, coming into the... So he and Dennis sat there just shooting animals until there were no more. And once there was no more coming out, it was the middle of the night. They looked, and he said it was dogs, basically. They thought it was like coyotes or wolves. They left their tents where they were. They kicked dirt on the fire. They got in their car. They went to town, got a hotel room. Then the next morning, they came back out, and there was like 12 dogs. And they all had collars, but the collars were all really, really old.
Right.
And they were feral dogs.
They were feral at that point, right.
But they, you know, which is... So they were just generally dogs, but they don't have any fear of humans at this point.
Right.
So they were hungry. They were going to come after them and get them some. And they ended up shooting, you know, 12 feral dogs just right there, like, in a circle around their fire, kind of set up a... He said it was probably one of the most scared he's ever been.
I'm sure.
He said then he thought later that it could have been hogs, so he was pretty lucky that it was dogs, and they went down with one shot.
Right.
Yeah, you know, like,
because a hog, once it gets that adrenaline going, it can. We used to hunt hogs with dogs, catch them alive and stuff, and yeah, those things,
they fight.
Oh yeah, I've seen them kill a pit bull really, really quick.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some mean bastards, man.
But yeah, you know, so you take the weapons factor away, and yeah. Those two guys just got attacked by something, ate up,
drained all the blood and everything else.
Yep. So I mean, it happens. There's a reason why we're afraid of the dark.
Yeah.
I mean.
Okay, moving on. I love this name right here, but the Mamba Muta. Vampire-like creature. It's kind of blood-sucking mermaid from Lake...
Please say Titicaca.
Tanganyika in Africa.
Oh,
Cryptozoologists think these reports could represent a freshwater manatee or some kind of other otter beast that that may be swimming around these lakes and is an explanation for a few things. The Mamba Muta is a very dangerous creature native form from Lake Tanganyika, located in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Which Congo is scary enough. You know, there's all kinds of stuff in the Congo. It's said to have arms similar to those of a lobster, a fish-like tail, and its head has a very humanoid appearance. Natives from the Congo stated that the Mamba Muta likes to feed on the blood of children. The name originates from Swahili Bantu, or Crocodile Man. In Central Africa, there are legends of a creature called the Mamba Muta. Legends often describe it as an insect-like creature that appears half-human, half-lobster. Very similar to what we know as a mermaid. That is where the similarity, however, ends. In that the Mamba Muta is considered a very dangerous creature. It is said that it survives by sucking human blood, just as a vampire would, and eats brains. The creature is... Here's an artist's rendering of the Mamba Muta. Very scary looking mermaid, essentially. It eats brains. It specifically inhabit Lake Tanganyika and the Lukuga River in the Congo. Moving out of legend and into fact, the lake is also home to some ferocious fish, such as the tiger fish, which is a huge fish, largest reaching as big as 5 feet, with dagger-like teeth. There's considerable debate as to whether or not the stories about the Mamba Muta are true. Disbelievers in the Mamba Muta rationalize the stories by claiming that perhaps the legends are based on manatees or even some type of giant otter. Manatees are plant eaters.
They're pretty chill.
I've swum with them in Mexico before. Mm-hmm. There's great videos of me and my daughter swimming with them. And otters, I don't see. Otter saved a man recently. Remember, God sent an otter to save that guy.
It's just thinking of was it One Crazy Summer?
Yeah,
it's the Foam 2.
Foam 2, yeah. The dolphin with rabies.
The giant dolphin with rabies.
You could have a manatee with rabies that may be attacking people and living off of the blood of children. So that is another interesting one. And moving on, there's lots of carnivorous plants that we've heard about. And, you know, legends of carnivorous plants, think about Venus flytrap. You know, I've had them as, I had them as little oddities to have around the house for the kids. They're normally very small. They eat small gnats or fruit flies, stuff like that.
Let me, real quick.
Yeah.
So, on Scary Dad's Haunted Forum, and I felt for this chick because then afterwards I looked at the picture and I realized that it was like a forced perspective sort of thing. But last year my wife brought me home a Venus flytrap and I took a picture of it. And this thing was like half the size of a beer can, right? Like
right.
The pot and the plant all told were about
tiny.
Like 4 inches high. But the way I had taken the picture, the plant itself had something behind it and it made the plant look huge. And for a guess, you know, like sometimes if somebody takes a picture of a snake, you know, but it's like right up close, you can't tell if that snake's 6 inches or 6 feet, right?
Right.
So anyway, I was like, check out my plant. And this girl was like, you know, oh my God, how big is that? And then somebody else, you know, she's like, what kind of plant is that? And, you know, how big is it? And somebody else, just joshing with her, commented, it's like the one from Little Shop of Horrors. She's like, oh my God, I didn't think those things were real. And so then I, like, instant messenger, I was like, I can see why you think because of the size, the forced perspective.
Right.
I was like... But no, it's like, because I think it was like the plant was up close and my little girl was like far away, but whenever you looked at it, they looked like they were standing next to each other. That's what it was. And like, once I realized, like, what does she look? That thing looks like it's like 2 feet tall. Like,
well, I'm here to let her know that, you know, there may be some things out there similar to the Little Shop of Horrors creature.
Feed old, me.
Yeah, what was his name? Audrey 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Audrey 2. All right.
One of Steve Martin's best roles.
Psycho Dennis. Yeah. And Bill Murray in there wanting to get his root canal. Okay. We'll start off in Madagascar. Now, Madagascar has a lot of cool stuff. They have a lot of big things. The largest tortoise in the world comes from Madagascar. The Komodo dragon comes from Madagascar, which is the largest land lizard. Madagascar is also home to the man-eating trees of Madagascar. Purportedly home to at least two distinct types of mysterious carnivorous flora,
Perhaps the most well-known comes from an old account brought back from the deepest jungles by the German explorer Carl Leisch in 1878. The account describes in horrific detail the sacrifice of a village woman of the Makoto tribe to a giant flesh-eating tree. In a letter published in the South Australian Register in 1881, Leisch described the unsettling scene that unfolded before him and his cohort, a man only known as Hendrik. Leisch writes, "The slender, delicate palpi, with the fury of starved serpents, quivered a moment over her head. Then, as if instinct with demonic intelligence fastened upon her in sudden coils, round and round her neck and arms. Then, while her awful screams and yet more awful laughter rose wildly to be instantly strangled down again into a gurgling moan, the tendrils, one after another, like great green serpents with brutal energy and infernal rapidity, rose, retracted themselves, and wrapped her about in fold after fold, ever tightening with cruel swiftness and savage tenacity of anacondas fastening upon their prey." So this cat witnessed.
He was familiar with anacondas, though.
Yes.
I was going to say, because if
he's an explorer.
Well, no. What I mean is, that sounds like a snake attack. Sounds like a snake attack.
Right.
Like, you could attribute to somebody who's never seen that.
A snake in a tree. Right.
But if he's familiar with an anaconda and he knows that that's not it.
Right.
Ooh.
The tree itself was described as being around 8 feet in height and having an appearance reminiscent of a pineapple, with 8 long pointed leaves that hung down from its top to its ground. The trunk of the tree was topped with a sort of receptacle that contained a thick liquid said to have soporific qualities that drug potential prey and was believed to be highly addictive. Surrounding this receptacle were long hairy tendrils with 6 white palpi resembling tentacles. The tree possessed white and transparent leaves that reminded Leisch of the quivering mouth parts of an insect. There's a little artist rendering of... It's like a hydra. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically it's Medusa's head in a tree.
Wow.
The graphic account has inspired several expeditions to Madagascar in search of the tree. One such expedition was undertaken by Chase Salmon Osborne, the governor of Michigan, from 1911 to 1913. He went to the jungles to search for the man-eating tree. Although he was unsuccessful in his efforts to locate it, he did find both natives and Western missionaries that claimed to have seen it and that it did, in fact, exist. So that's a pretty crazy story.
Yeah.
Now we go on to the Nicaraguan vampire vine. Sounds pretty killer, doesn't it?
It does.
From the swamps of Nicaragua comes the rather bizarre account of the elusive and terrifying vampire vine. Vine is referred to by the natives as the devil's snare, and it is described as being rather like an octopus in appearance. The plant was described by one naturalist by the name of Mr. Dunstan, who came face to face with its horrifying nature while spending 2 years studying the plants and animals of the region. In the account, Dunstan claimed to have come across the plant while in the swamp region near Lake Nicaragua. Dunstan, who was collecting plant and insect specimens in the area, suddenly heard his dog let out a high-pitched whine of terror, pain, and both. Dunstan allegedly hurried to the source of the cries and found his dog enveloped by a network of rope-like roots and fibers. These fibers were a dark, nearly black hue and covered with a thick gum that seemed to exude from some sort of pores. Gum was reported extremely adhesive and had foul animal odor. The snared dog struggled within its fibrous network and was wailing as if in a great deal of pain. So essentially, he lashed him in, and the way he describes it, was able to recover from his gruesome sight. He tried to desperately cut the dog free from his knife, but found the vines to be surprisingly difficult to cut. And to his horror, found that the plant's rope-like tendrils actively wrapped and curled themselves around his hands like fingers. Dunstan was able to extricate the animal only after an enormous amount of effort, and he noticed that the grasping vines had left the skin of his hands red and blistered. So this stuff that it was exuding, this sticky, it was actually eating the flesh away. He also noticed to his amazement that the dog was blood-stained and covered in spots that seemed puckered, as if they had been sucked. The dog, though still alive, was extremely disoriented and had difficulty walking. The naturalist told the natives of his encounter, and they explained that the vine was well-known and feared in the area, warning him to stay well away from it. Undaunted, Dunstan tried to collect more information on the bizarre vine, but found it very difficult to approach or handle. However, through his observations, he deduced where the plant's remarkable suction abilities derive from and how it fed. According to his report, the plant's power of suction is contained within a number of infinitesimal mouths, or little suckers, which ordinarily closed, open for the reception of food. If the substance is animal, the blood is drawn off, and the carcass or refuse then dropped.
A lump of raw meat being thrown to it in the short space of 5 minutes, the blood will be thoroughly drunk off and mass thrown aside. Its veracity is almost beyond belief. Yeah, so only one person has ever had an encounter of this, except for local natives and stuff. But yeah, that's a pretty,
it's a pretty detailed
account that the guy had with it.
For sure.
It's definitely something I don't want to go look for. Eventually gave up his studies on the vampire vine, but very little is known about it. And staying in the area, Central American Killer Trees. Very simple name. No, to the point. Central American Killer Trees.
Mm-hmm.
Central America is purportedly home to a vicious man-eating tree known as Yeti Vio. The tree is said to have long spikes which it uses to impale victims, whereupon it absorbs the victim's blood. These spikes are spines of dagger-like thorns around the edges and hang to the ground where they lay hidden and still until prey comes along. When an unsuspecting victim steps among these barbed shoots, they spring to life, impale the victim, hold him there, and drain all the blood from him.
So it's like a landmine.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Pretty much. And here's an artist's rendition of one of these trees with its victims laying around the base. Other carnivorous plants have been reported from Mexico in the Sierra Madre area. A tree was reported that allegedly had branches with a slimy, snake-like appearance. One witness described seeing a bird land on one of the unusual branches and promptly be pulled down into the mass of other such branches. Indeed, the base of the tree was said to be littered with the bones and feathers of other unfortunate birds. That'd be freaky to walk up to a tree and you're looking around and there's just dead birds.
There's bones everywhere.
You're wondering where the hell all this stuff came from, and then as a bird lights, you'll see the tree suddenly eat it. You want to be careful what you climb around there for sure.
Yeah.
And then we go to the man-eating plants of South America. The jungles of South America hide several types of mysterious carnivorous plant. From Brazil come accounts of what is called the Brazilian devil tree, which is reportedly found in the Mato Grosso region. The tree is said to hide its branches in the leaves and undergrowth of the forest floor and sometimes even underground. When the victim passes, the branches reportedly wrap around and slowly constrict the victim to death, kind of like a snake would. Another plant reportedly found in the same region is known to have sweet-tasting berries in order to lure prey, said to consist of mostly birds. When a bird tries to eat the berries, the branches snap around the unsuspecting prey and crush it against the trunk to kill it.
Oh, wow.
After which the blood is sucked from the body at the plant's leisure and the body discarded. Also from Brazil, near the border of Guyana, comes the story of the monkey trap tree. Can you guess what they eat? Which is described by the explorer Mariano da Silva. The plant's preferred prey is said to be, as the name suggests, monkeys. They were attracted by an irresistible scent exuded by the tree. The tree then enveloped the monkey with large leaves and digested the body over a period of several days. Kind of like a Venus flytrap would.
Yeah.
After which the bones were dropped to the forest floor. Jesus, that is just horrific sounding, man. And there's trees like this reported everywhere. From the Philippines to India. One in India is actually the cow-eating tree of India. That's pretty big. A bizarre report comes from Padrame, India, where in 2007, a farmer's cow was reportedly attacked by a carnivorous tree. On 18th October 2007, a villager took his cow herd to graze in the forest near the village when one of the cows was suddenly grabbed by branches and unbelievably pulled from the ground. When he shouted for help, other villagers allegedly converged on the scene armed with knives and axes and proceeded to hack at the tree until it let the cow go. Apparently this sort of carnivorous tree is known to locals and it is called the Pilamara or the tiger tree. That's 2007. That's pretty damn recent.
Yeah,
it's something we could take a trip and go check out for ourselves, man. It's this I've actually heard of before many times, but the death flower of the South Pacific. Somewhere in the South Pacific lies a forgotten island of El Benor. The place is said to be home of a man-eating flower known only as the death flower. The flower's existence is mostly known through the 1581 account of the explorer Captain Arkwright, who wrote of it in his journals of his travels. He described the plant as basically a huge, brightly colored flower with large petals. The flower reportedly could release a soporific, sleep-inducing aroma, whereupon the victim would lie down upon one of the petals, and once this happens, the flower would close and digest his sleeping prey alive. It seems like a fascinating account, but since it is only one report and the location of El Benor is not specifically explained, it seems unlikely we will ever know for sure just how much veracity this account holds. But think about, like, in cartoons and stuff, when you saw man-eating plants, like mm-hmm. Popeye. Papa used to go to that island where all the things with the long necks and stuff were. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a plant like that that would reach down, grab you, and go to eat you. And Popeye could break out of it, of course, because he'd eat spinach real quick with his pipe. He was able to get superhuman strength and break out. But, you know, the idea of these carnivorous plants has been around for a while.
Oh, absolutely. Well, just, you know, Venus flytraps. So I know there's another one. It's an American one. It's not a carnivorous plant, but it is so deadly. It's like, if you touch it, it, like, leaves, like, welts, like, big, massive blisters that'll, like, it's like third-degree burns on your skin.
Right. But there's plants that have defense mechanisms. I mean, we used to call this one plant, and I see the weed around here all the time. I have no idea what the actual name is, but we used to call it Indian fire. And what it is, it touches you, and it immediately starts burning. It just, it leaves these little, just microscopic fibers into your skin that hurt like hell, man. And plants have defense mechanisms like that. You got to wonder, you got to believe that they can evolve to the point to where they can actually kill you pretty easily.
Everything else does.
Yeah. Look at The Happening. Or don't.
Yeah, don't.
Trust me. Don't watch that movie. Don't give it any play, please. Love you, Marky Mark, but that was a mistake.
So, are you going to get to the chupacabra or not?
I was going to let you jump on that one if you'd like to. I know the chupacabra is always fun to talk about. I was kind of saving that for last.
Well, the thing about the chupacabra is it is very much, very most likely. I mean, you can't argue with a peasant farmer who's getting his livestock killed. Like, that's life or death for them.
Right.
Right? So often in our modern world, it's like, oh, you know, there's a coyote ate a dog, and you're like, oh, that's, or an alligator ate a family pet or something. You're like, oh, that's tragic. But even though it makes some people cry, there's no real actual
life's gonna go on.
Yeah. But, you know, whenever you have a farmer that's got like four goats and, you know, he's got a couple breeding pairs, and that's part of his livelihood through milk and meat.
He's got kids to feed.
And he goes out and he finds three of them torn apart and their blood drained. You know, whether it's a rabid dog or a rabid cat or some new form of cryptid, I believe that it happened for sure. Now, I believe they started off in Puerto Rico. They've been reported in, like, North Carolina and then parts of South America.
Mm-hmm.
The first reporting of them ever was in 1995. So that's one of the things that makes them a little bit less credible, so to speak. But at the same time, I mean, modern life is changing creatures' behavior. Like, I do believe, I was reading something not too long ago that was talking about how, although wolves, like, bears are different, but although wolves have always gotten a bad rap and people are afraid of them and stuff, there hadn't been an actual attack on a human by a wolf since, like, 1831 or something.
The scary creatures.
And even then, it was a starving wolf that was coming across, you know, like, in the snow. He was desperate.
Right.
It wasn't, normally wolves leave people alone and they have the fear factor, but this one was just like, I'm about to die,
I gotta eat something.
I'm gonna Leroy Jenkins this thing. You know? But that was 1831. So, if, like, for 150 years, there's been no wolves attack people. But in the last, like, 5 years, there's been quite a few of random attacks by animals that historically have never really attacked people before. And it's because we're encroaching on their habitat.
Yeah.
And it's not because the animals, like, it's not like The Happening where suddenly the animals are flipping a switch. It's, you push something far enough, long enough, eventually they're gonna snap.
Well, you're also encroaching on their habitat, so you take away that fear factor that they had of you before.
Right. So, what is the chupacabra? The answer, I don't know what it actually is, whether it's whether it's some sort of demon vampire thing, or whether it's a rabid dog, or, you know, a jackalope. I don't know what it is, but I believe it. I believe something exists.
Yeah, it's based off of something that actually exists.
Yeah. And I believe that there's going to be more of them. I believe that it's going to, you know, because that's another thing too, is like these certain areas that have been, let's just call them rural areas, that they don't have the benefit of mass communication. They don't have benefit of the internet. They don't, you know, it's like we had talked about, you know, the Appalachian people, the Louisiana people.
Right.
You know, there's entire generations of folks who have grown up and never seen a television before.
Right.
And you think, okay, well, you know, they're off. There's also there's multiple generations of us that haven't seen them before.
Right.
We don't know what language they speak. We don't know.
And there's also creatures that we've known. I remember the way he put it was kind of misworded, but I was back when I used to have my lake house, one of the guys from out there in the sticks in central Louisiana, we're riding around this island in the middle of the lake, and he told me, he said, you know, there's deer out there that have never been, eyes have never been laid on these deer before, and they're huge monster bucks. And so I said, well, how do you know if eyes have never been laid on them before? But it's true when you think about what he says. You know, there's areas that nobody's ever gone back there to hunt it and seen what's back there. You don't know what kind of feral hogs are back there. Hogzilla might actually exist somewhere back there.
Well,
you know,
there's been some hogzillas that are pretty right. damn big.
Oh yeah.
Well, and I also think too of like gorillas. I mean, I believe it's like 1847, so I mean that's still a long time ago in our, you know, frame of reference. They were 100% pure myth. Myth. They were a cryptid. And they were the stuff of legend and myth, and nobody believed it. And if you talked about a gorilla, everybody thought you were funny. But now it's pretty much a given.
Right.
And also I think too that I was talking with a friend of mine not too long ago, and we were discussing he and I were discussing the show and how we're talking about cryptids and lake monsters and stuff like that. And your perspective on things is different because we live in a very secular, scientific world. And the subject we got onto was just kind of like, okay, so, you know, think about like dinosaurs, you know, think about dragons to dinosaurs. And then you think about, you know, people back in the day, as far as they were concerned, that thing died not too long ago. You know, there's a dead one over there. Like, its bones are here.
Right.
Its descendants are around here somewhere.
Right.
Or they left. But there's no reason to think that they're all gone, that they're all dead. And that's how these legends come up. But at the same time, we can say with absolute, I'm putting absolute in quotation marks, we can say with absolute certainty that humans and dinosaurs did not walk on Earth at the same time. Except that that's not exactly true. True, the Tyrannosaurus and any semblance of what a modern human would be never did. But not all the dinosaurs died.
Right.
Because there had to be something to carry on the gene pool.
Yeah.
The dinosaurs and everything that was living on Earth didn't just fall down dead and then, you know, single-cell organisms start over again.
There are prehistoric versions of alligators. There are prehistoric versions of tortoises.
And sharks and everything else. And there are links between them.
Mm-hmm.
Some greatly changed, some mostly unchanged. A lot of them are birds. But to say as an absolute matter of fact, like, well, no, because we are walking on the earth with alligators, and they're largely unchanged from their prehistoric ancestors, except for they're a little smaller.
Right.
But there's a lot of stuff hidden in the depths and in the deep.
Well, yeah,
and
the
mountains
it.
And
you know, let's say you're this prehistoric beast that's realizing these humans are actually killing off a bunch of your friends. I need to go hide somewhere if I'm wanting to survive. I need to go somewhere where they're not going to be able to find it. So they migrate over. To us, they're extinct. They don't exist anymore. But they're just playing it safe.
Yeah.
You know, how long did that go on for?
And then they evolve.
Yeah.
They evolve into something else. Maybe something quite similar, but maybe just smaller and a little bit sleeker, and maybe something with feathers instead of scales.
Right.
It doesn't mean it's the, I mean, it's not the same creature, but it's, you know, like,
it's going to have similar attributes to it.
Can you imagine going and digging up a Neanderthal? Which actually, I think they've pretty much proven that Neanderthals and humans we killed them off. Like, we didn't, like, we were at one point at the same, you know, we coexisted.
Yeah.
And we killed them off. But can you imagine, like, going and digging up a Neanderthal skeleton? Or, like, excavating one of their caves? Like, they've got fires.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got art, they've got tools, and they're huge. And they don't, I mean, their brow and everything, they don't look like us. They look sort of like, they're giants.
Right.
There's nothing you can, there's no other way you can compare it to anything other than our concept of a giant until you bring science in and they categorize things.
Yeah.
Until you bring that scientific method in there, that's the stuff of legend. And they're right there.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean they're all gone. It means they went somewhere.
Yeah, you don't need that. You haven't seen one in a while.
And they might be coming back. So always be prepared for the giants that live in the mountains. Because I've been up there. I didn't see a live one, but I saw a few dead ones. And they're as real as anything.
Right.
So, what do you think? Is this a good spot to move before we move into the folklore side?
I think part two? I think so.
Awesome. Hey, guys. Thank you so much for...
Hope you enjoyed our cryptid episode.
Joining us in episode 40. Damn, it doesn't seem like that long.
Like I said, we still got plenty to talk about, so...
Yeah, we're not going anywhere. There's as much crazy crap as there is out there.
Oh, yeah. Subject matter just keeps rolling on in, man.
It's cool. We'll hit you up with an update on Scary Dad's Haunted Halloween show coming up soon.
Which is looking like it's going to be a blast and definitely a can't miss for Houston.
Exactly. So we'll hit you up with a little bit more detail on that as it comes. In the meantime, guys, stay scary.
Later.
Why?